Welcome to Deception in the Last Days with your host, Randy Shelton. Randy is a member of the Biblical Discernment and Research Center. He has been studying cults and new religious movements for over 30 years. Join Randy as he discerns the deception going on now in the last days.
We are going to continue to be looking at events that seem to be setting the stage for the future Gog-Magog invasion of Israel that you can read all about in Ezekiel 38-39. The Old Testament prophet Ezekiel was given this prophecy, at least 2,500 years ago, but very relevant for today, as I think if you've been following the podcast, you can see, and hopefully as you might as well see tonight. Last week, we looked at six recent or current events helping to set the stage for Ezekiel 38 and 39. This is the Gog-Magog invasion. That's the term that can be used for when I quote those chapters in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which I often do. We also looked at various views for the timing of this event. And one of the five articles that I have updating the assassination of the father of Iran's nuclear program. So once again, thank you for joining me. And I want to jump right in with the next article of the four more articles concerning this assassination of this man by the name of Fakhrizadeh. He is known as the father of the Iranian nuclear program. And this is from the Jerusalem Post. The title is, Will Biden Return to the Iran Deal After the Assassination? This is November 29th, 2020. Last week, and this was actually November 27th when this took place, Prime Minister Netanyahu sent a clear message to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden that he would oppose American efforts to rejoin the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, Iranian nuclear deal. Do not return to the previous Iran nuclear deal, Netanyahu said at a memorial service for Israel's first Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. We must keep to an uncompromising policy to ensure that Iran does not develop nuclear weapons. Netanyahu credited Israel's determined stance against Israel's nuclearization and our opposition to the nuclear deal with Iran, along with Arab countries changing their stance on Israel. On Friday, Biden and the Iranians received an even stronger message. Iran's top nuclear scientist, and I've already mentioned his name, so I won't butcher it again, was targeted in a sophisticated assassination near Tehran. He was the only Iranian scientist named in the IAEA's 2015 final assessment of open questions about Iran's nuclear program. Although there is no official word on who was responsible for killing him, and it could be more than one country, Iran has blamed Israel's Mossad. That's their secret intelligence service. Certainly no tears were shed for him in Israel, nor in Saudi Arabia, which has suffered repeatedly from Iranian-sponsored attacks, and the other Gulf countries that feel threatened by Iran's ongoing nuclear aspirations. Some experts speculate that Iran will hold off or moderate its response to his killing in order not to anger the incoming Biden administration. And again, this is the presumption that Biden will be the incoming administration, which it looks more and more like that, unfortunately, is the case. But anyway, Iran is clearly hurt and humiliated by this latest in a string of incidents that include the archive heist. And some of these events, I'm not completely familiar with the archive heist, but I am with the killing of Qassem Soleimani, who was the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, a series of fires in its nuclear facilities, which I also remember reading about, and hits on its targets on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights, where it is trying to establish a foothold, and more. The original deal let Iran think it could buy time and then carry on with its nuclear program. But it is important that it doesn't come to believe that it can ride out the next the few years of a particular U.S. president or an Israeli prime minister and then continue as planned. While it is natural that Biden will want to reverse many of Trump's policies, it is essential that the new U.S. administration maintain pressure on Iran. And I would say don't count on it if Biden is the president at that time. Now, I want to read another article. As I mentioned, there originally were five. I read one last week. This is the second tonight. And or whenever you're listening to this. This is from Reuters, and this was December the 7th, 2020, by the Reuters staff. Iran says smart satellite-controlled machine gun killed top nuclear scientist. This says the killing of Iran's top nuclear scientist last month was carried out remotely with artificial intelligence and a machine gun equipped with a satellite-controlled smart system. So you have a little bit of difference in the accounts of who and how this actually took place. I think more and more this is what I've been confirming, is that it's the artificial intelligence machine gun equipped satellite controlled smart system. Tasnim news agency quoted a senior commander as saying Iran has blamed Israel for the assassination of the man we've quoted before, who was seen by Western intelligence services as the mastermind of a covert Iranian program to develop nuclear weapons capability. Tehran has long denied any such ambition. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility for the killing, and one of its officials suggested that the Tasnim report of the tactics used was a face-saving gambit by Iran. What I see is a great deal of embarrassment on the Iranian side. Gallant, a former naval commando and deputy chief of Israel's military, told Army Radio, it would appear that those who were responsible for his security, the Iranian scientists, are now coming up with reasons for not having fulfilled that mission. He was identified by Israel as a prime player in what it says is a continuing Iranian quest for a nuclear weapon. He was the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist killed in targeted attacks since 2010 inside Iran, and the second slaying of a high-ranking Iranian official in 2020, and that would be Soleimani, which the article goes on to talk about. The commander of the Revolutionary Guard's elite Quds force, Qassem Soleimani, was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January. Tehran retaliated by firing missiles at U.S. military targets in Iraq. And you know that this was November 27th, as I said, when this took place. And this actually leads me to, I wanted to make some comments concerning a man by the name of Gerald Bull. And, you know, he was the man who invented this super gun, doomsday gun, that the Iraqi Saddam Hussein wanted to use to attack Israel by putting nuclear tips or, pestilence type, chemical warfare and other type warfare, and attacking Israel with this gun. And it just brings to my mind, as I remember, that this man, Gerald Bull, this Canadian genius, was also assassinated. And to this day, to my knowledge, it's not known who did it, although, of course, Israel is blamed, since this was specifically going to be used by the Iraqis to attack Israel. now, the pieces of this gun, this giant super gun, were caught in customs on the way to Iraq. And maybe this is an example of God watching out for Israel. Maybe an example of Israel under God's protection, that they're dwelling in peace, that I talked about last week as I quoted an article of a God's sovereignty in taking care of Israel at times such as these, and leading to the possible imminent attack of the Ezekiel 38-39 Gog-Magog coalition. But I, it was just interesting to me as I remembered what took place, And it made me wonder, well, it seems like there's always somebody that steps up to the plate to try to do evil. And usually gets blown off the plate, if you'll excuse the expression, one way or the other, you know, like Gerald Bull, and like this man, the Iranians' leading nuclear scientist. But I can't help but wonder if they would not be able to find someone else or hire someone else. But anyway, let's look at another article. The consequences of this nuclear scientist's killing. This is from the Bessa Center. Dr. Raphael Ofek, December 3rd, 2020. The killing of him raises a number of questions. Did he remain active in the Iranian nuclear program after the JCPOA, which of course is the nuclear U.S. nuclear deal with Iran we mentioned? There is no clear answer to this question, as ever since 2015, Iran has concealed its activities related to the development of nuclear weapons, including those of this nuclear scientist. It is likely that he continued to be active in Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons following the signing of the deal, albeit covertly and in fields of theoretical calculation. Another consideration, how will the regime be affected by the loss of him? He was not only a good scientist, but an excellent manager, and it is not certain that he had an equal among the Iranian nuclear scientists who remain. See, we don't know, do we? It is likely that his death had a severely demoralizing effect not only on the Iranian nuclear community, but on the regime as a whole, as the killing of key figures and the mysterious explosions inside Iran over the course of the year point to a chronic failure of Iranian internal intelligence. How will Iran react? Though senior Iranian officials have promised revenge for the killing of him, of the nuclear scientist, given Israel's demonstrated capabilities vis-a-vis Iran on the military intelligence and clandestine fronts, Tehran is likely to be very careful about the intensity of its response, if indeed ever, if one ever comes. And my comments here would really, you know, Iran always reminds me of Wile E. Coyote versus the Roadrunner, as I reference a cartoon here. You know, it seems like they always end up with gunpowder on their face, because when they deal with Israel, they come out on the losing end. I will also say my opinion is I don't think Iran will ever be able to attack Israel with nukes. There's really nothing in the Bible to indicate this, but there is, of course, the indication that Iran and others are going to be in the coalition that attacks Israel with an army and will be destroyed. But, I mean, Israel won't apparently receive a scratch, you know, from how it appears, as God will defend them. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But anyway, that's an opinion that I have. I don't think we really have to worry about these nuclear weapons, although it's understandable when you have a rogue, insane, regime like this to deal with, you have to be concerned when nukes are involved. Now, getting back to this article, what are the policy implications? The depth of the regime's mourning over this man suggests that the nuclear program he headed was aimed at developing nuclear weapons, contrary to what Tehran has claimed over the years. The political consequences of the killing will depend largely on two things: the severity of the Iranian response and the conduct of the U.S. The situation created by the death will likely affect the Biden administration's intention and ability to return the U.S. to the nuclear deal. It also remains possible that President Trump will carry out some form of military action against Iran in the waning days of his presidency. Again, this is assuming that Biden will be the next president. At this time, you know, of my sharing this, it's still not completely certain. The waning days of his presidency, which would further complicate the situation. As for Israel, this nuclear scientist's killing seems to strengthen Jerusalem's growing ties with the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, which fear Biden's intention to return to the JCPOA deal and improve U.S. relations with Tehran, a scenario that could encourage them to view Israel as the only country capable of defending them against Iran. Of course, these are all secular articles that I'm reading from. Very interesting, but not from a Christian perspective. But lining up so much in as we see this possible setting of the stage for this invasion sometime in the future, whether near or otherwise. And now the fifth article that I want to look at here is entitled Biden and Israel's Unsteady Right by Carolyn Glick. This was published December the 4th, 2020. And it was in, it's at the Israel Hayom site. All right. Now, in an interview with the New York Times Tuesday, presumptive, and that's a better way of, I like that term better, presumptive President-elect Joe Biden reaffirmed his plan to return the U.S. to the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. The U.S. will rescind its economic sanctions on Iran if it complies with the nuclear deal's limitations on its nuclear activities. Once this happens, Biden said he will seek to negotiate a new longer-term nuclear deal with Iran's Ayatollahs. The current deal expires in 5 years. Biden insisted the goal of his policy is to prevent Iran from getting the bomb. But practically speaking, Biden's policy guarantees Iran will develop a nuclear arsenal and the missiles to deliver them. This is true both because the nuclear deal will expire and Iran will be free to build nuclear bombs as it likes in 2025, and because the 2015 nuclear deal has no effective enforcement mechanism. The UN inspectors tasked with ensuring Iranian compliance are only permitted to enter civilian nuclear sites. This kind of reminds me of what happened during our elections here in the States. Sounds a little bit like the treatment of the voting observers who were not allowed to get close enough to observe. Anyway, since Iran has sole authority to determine if a site is civilian or military, it can and has rendered the deal's inspection regime a pathetic joke. It goes without saying that Israel cannot accept this state of affairs, just as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was compelled to oppose Barack Obama's nuclear deal, so Israel has no choice but to strongly oppose Biden's plan. Unfortunately, Israel is currently incapable of clearly opposing Biden's plan that will give the mullahs the means to carry out their plan to destroy the Jewish state. That is because currently Israel doesn't have one government. It has two governments pretending to be a unity government. But in practice, they disagree on everything, including how to handle Biden's Iran policy and pursue contrary policies on all issues. Sounds, once again, a lot like the U.S. Situation here, being totally split. Biden's determination to return to the nuclear deal without conditions except an unenforceable Iranian commitment to limit its nuclear activities makes clear that there will be no reconsideration of anything. As to his plan to negotiate a new deal, Iran will have little reason to do so. By ending Trump's sanctions, Biden will lose all leverage. And these are the comments of Carolyn Glick, who is a very good observer on things concerning Israel in the Middle East. Now, I want to turn to a book that I have quoted from in the past, very interesting book called The Final Chapter by S. Maxwell Coder. And in this book, we want to look at, we've looked at some of his material in the past. We want to look at a few other items here. And this is concerning God's weapons that he will use against Israel's enemies. And so we want to look at some of these. Ezekiel reveals that no Jewish army will confront the enemy and no allies will come to Israel's aid. And that's why I say, you know, Israel really won't get a scratch on them when this invasion takes place, as far as I can see, as far as I understand, because of God's sovereign protection. This amazing, miraculous thing that's going to take place sometime in the future. So we're going to look at some of God's weapons against Israel's enemies. It says the only action against the prince of Rosh, and that's Russia, will come from God, whose fury and wrath are manifested when his land is invaded. He will take up the same weapons he used to defend his people in the Old Testament. The first of these is an earthquake. There shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel. I'm quoting Ezekiel here. The mountains shall be thrown down and every wall shall fall to the ground. That's Ezekiel 38:19 and 20. God used this weapon when Jonathan went out against the Philistines near Gibeah, when the earth quaked, 1 Samuel 14:15. God will also call for a sword against the enemy throughout all his mountains. Every man's sword will be against his brother, Ezekiel 38:21. When Gideon's chosen 300 men blew their trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow. That was in the Old Testament, in the book of Judges, chapter 7, 22, verse 22. And the Midianites were driven away. There is a third divine weapon. God says, I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood. Ezekiel 38:22. This is a reminder of the time when a plague killed 185,000 Assyrians who were besieging Jerusalem in 2 Kings 19:35. A fourth weapon will be an overflowing rain and great hailstones. Ezekiel 38:22. The tremendous, you know, this isn't science fiction, folks. This is God Almighty in action at some future point, maybe sooner than we think. The tremendous destructive power of these earth hailstones was seen when God saved the Jews from the Amorites in the days of Joshua. They were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword, Joshua 10:11. Hailstones are also mentioned in Revelation 16:21, when the seventh vial of the wrath of God is poured on the earth. Finally, fire and brimstone are mentioned in the arsenal of weapons used against Gog, as when the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Genesis 19:24. God will send fire on Magog, the land from which the invading hosts have come, Ezekiel 39:6. Now we want to look at the weapons of the invaders. This is, again, from the same book. The most difficult question about this prophecy concerns the weaponry of the invaders. It is usually assumed that we cannot take Ezekiel's language literally because he speaks of such things as bows, arrows, and spears. Some would alter the text by substituting what are called equivalent words when the text is applied to the last days. These people change inspired language on the theory that the prophet used the terminology of a bygone era and that it could not possibly apply to a modern army. This, of course, according to Mr. Coder, and I believe he's correct, is a denial of the doctrine of verbal inspiration of the text of the Bible. He goes on to say, a far simpler explanation is possible. Hebrew is a language of word pictures. Words are often descriptions of the things they refer to. Dog, translated literally, is a barker. A fox is a burrower. A sparrow is a hopper. A serpent is a hisser. The sun is the shining one. A palm tree is the straight or erect one. Similar words in English are not easy to find. They include such descriptive terms as woodpecker, flyer, rower, and flamethrower. The invaders are said to have horses, Ezekiel 38:4. The Hebrew word for horse is sus, meaning something which leaps forward, a leaper. The original root is also used of birds in Isaiah 38:14. It is a word picture of something which propels itself forward over the ground or through the air. The word translated horseman may refer to riders on horses, and I'm thinking of the Cossacks, the Russian Cossacks. I don't know if there are any of those still hanging around. That's my comments. But he goes on to say, or to drivers of wheeled vehicles, such as the chariots of Exodus. The word translated sword is literally a cutting or destroying instrument. The word for arrow means a piercing missile, and the word for bow means a launching device for such a missile. All these words meant something specific and familiar to the people of Ezekiel's day. When this passage is read as a description of weapons used by armies in the last days before the Lord returns, it is not necessary to attach the ancient meanings to these word pictures. For example, we need not translate Ezekiel 39:3 as it is rendered in the Authorized Version, and I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. If we use the word pictures instead of what was meant in ancient times, the verse translates, and I will smite thy launcher out of thy left hand and I will cause thy missiles to fall out of thy right hand. Such a translation is free of the problems presented by insisting these Hebrew words be translated today as they were in Ezekiel's time. The word pictures can describe modern weapons just as accurately as they describe those in use 2,500 years ago. What is true of the bows and arrows of this prophecy is true of other words. A sus was a horse in Ezekiel. It may refer to a different kind of leaper when it is used of the latter days. The word translated shield was something that protected its user. The same word is used of the scales or protective hide of a crocodile in Job 41:15. The Hebrew word translated buckler comes, I'm going to skip that. A hand stave was an object held in the hand, such as a rod, but the Hebrew root means to germinate or to shoot forth. Jesenius renders the word as dart or javelin in Ezekiel 39:9. The word translated spear was something thrown or hurled. It may be a rendered projectile, and it might refer to a hand grenade or a similar weapon. The people from the cities of Israel will gather the weapons of the northern armies and burn them for fuel. Some have imagined this calls for immense piles of wooden bows, arrows, and spears, but the Hebrew word for weapons is simply military equipment. In modern warfare, it would include vast quantities of combustible fuel. It is perfectly reasonable that such fuel sufficient for large armies could supply the decimated population of Israel for 7 years, Ezekiel 39:8. To say nothing of the individual pieces of equipment described only by word pictures. And he mentioned the decimated population of Israel. So I may be incorrect in saying that the hand's not laid upon them, you know, or that they're not harmed. I'm not sure. I'm going to leave it at that. Moving on, when body armor began to be used by modern soldiers, some thought this was a fulfillment of Ezekiel 38:4. The invading armies were described as clothed in all sorts of armor. However, the word armor is in italics because it is not found in the original Hebrew. What Ezekiel actually wrote was all of them clothed in all sorts. He did not finish his statement, as though no words were available to him to tell us what he saw. There was something so strange in his vision that it could not be portrayed in the vocabulary of that age. I have a little time. I'll see if I can run through here. Why is God behind the attacks? It is evident that God could have prevented this invasion had he chosen to do so. Instead, God is quoted as saying to the prince of Rosh, "I will bring thee against my land," Ezekiel 38:16. Why should Ezekiel say God will be behind the attack? The answer is given immediately, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. Five similar statements appear in the text. Various scriptures explain these statements. When thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. Isaiah 26:9. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. 2 Peter 3:9. Such passages are keys to the history of mankind. When the armies of Russia invade Israel, time will be running out for the human race. The opportunity for men to be saved and to have a part in the millennial kingdom of Christ will soon be over. Yet vast numbers will still be in rebellion against God, refusing his message of deliverance and failing to repent when the vials of his wrath are poured out. Revelation 16:9-11. Well, I'm going to finish these last comments of this very interesting chapter from this book next week, as I'm out of time. God bless you. Please join me next week. Good night.